My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production in association with City News.
A quick warning. Today's episode of The Big Story is not easy to listen to. It wasn't easy for our guest to report either. But it's important.
They gave it to him on Wednesday. He picked up Kira on Friday and killed her on Sunday.
Is it the norm to hand somebody a report that suggests you are high risk to your own child and then say, go take the child for the weekend?
No, it's abnormal.
This is a story about a little girl named Kira. If the system worked the way it's supposed to, you wouldn't have to know Kira's name, and neither would I. She would just be a little girl, one of millions, going to school, playing with toys, growing up. But the system doesn't work, so here we are.
The courts and the Child Protective Agency didn't allow me to protect my child.
There's not much more for me to tell you here. 3 years ago, Kira died. She was with her father. There were screaming warnings that she shouldn't have been, but she was. It was a failure, and then a tragedy, and then 3 years of bullshit. And this week, a report detailing exactly how often and how badly the system failed Kira and her mother. And others like them. So what happened to Kira? More importantly, how was it allowed to happen? And how do we fix this? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Cynthia Mulligan is a longtime reporter at City News, one of our favorite guests on this podcast. She's been following and chasing Kira's story for a long time now. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Jordan.
Before we get to all the awful stuff that makes me and you and probably everybody listening sad and angry, why don't we take a couple minutes? You could just tell me about Kira. Who is she?
Well, Kira had the brightest smile. I've been given extensive video of her from her mother, and she just had this beautiful, charming way about her. She's described as spunky, as inquisitive. But it's the smile that really strikes me when I see all these videos of her and all the photos of her. And she just seems so full of joy.
What about her and her family? What that dynamic was, and just kind of set us up so we can tell her story properly.
Kira was in junior kindergarten. She was just 4 years old when she died. Her time was spent with both of her parents, who had divorced and had separated when she was just 8 months old. The mother left the marriage. Kira's mother is a doctor. The father, Robin Brown, an engineer. And they were married for about 2.5 years. But the mother cites abuse and coercive control in the marriage, including at one point when she was 8 months pregnant with Kira, Robin Brown shoved a dead mouse into her mouth. When she left, a lengthy court battle over custody began. Kira was 8 months old, and that battle continued until the very day that she died, along with her father, Robin Brown. The two fell from a cliff at Rattlesnake Point, which is at a conservation area in Milton. And up until now, the deaths have been determined inconclusive. But I obtained two new reports into the death, which are just damning. And the coroner's report finds that the case is largely consistent with past murder-suicides and that likely Robin Brown did this in an act of revenge against Kira's mother.
I mentioned in the intro to this episode that none of us would be even talking about Kira if the system worked. How exactly did the system fail to protect Kira?
The system failed on every level. every single level. So to begin with, in the courts, in the family law courts, they did not appear to recognize that this was a case of domestic violence. Instead, they looked at it as a high conflict case, which means two parents battling each other. And that means that the proper systems to protect Kira were not put in place. The first judge that saw the case deemed that Jennifer Kagan, Kira's mother, was right to leave the marriage. And he recognized that there was violence in the marriage, abuse in the marriage. But the second judge, who determined the custody arrangement, found that domestic abuse was not relevant when it comes to parenting, when in fact we know there are reams of evidence that a parent who is abusive can also abuse the child and is more likely to abuse the child. So the judge just did not recognize this. And then you have the Children's Aid Society. You had two that were largely involved. A third was brought in. It was an Indigenous Children's Aid Society because the father claimed he had Indigenous roots. And that CAS determined that that was not the case. So there were two Children's Aid Societies involved. Ultimately, it was left to the Jewish Family and Child Services Agency. For years, Jennifer had been telling the courts that Robin Brown was dangerous and she was worried. And nobody listened up until the very days leading up to Kira's death. A judge, at Jennifer's request, asked for a risk assessment and said, don't worry, the Jewish Children Family Services is going to look into this. And if there's a problem, they can raise the alarm. Well, just 3 days before Kira's death, the CAS worker called Jennifer and said, I believe he is exhibiting behavior that is consistent with a parent that could kill or harm their child.
Why didn't everything stop there?
It's a wonderful question. The CAS worker, Jennifer says, told her that her supervisor said, we can discuss this on Monday. This is the Friday before Robin Brown is scheduled by the courts to pick up Kira for the weekend. Robin Brown was also given that risk assessment report. He was given it on the Wednesday. He's picking up Kira on the Friday. On that Friday, the caseworker tells Jennifer, despite her concerns, it's going to be dealt with on the Monday. Kira died on the Sunday.
Let's talk about this new report for a moment and the risk factors, which you've mentioned. Give me a sense of what those risk factors are and how is it that the courts could miss that?
So, Jordan, out of the 22 risk factors that the report finds that Robin Brown exhibited, they include prior hostage-taking or forcible confinement, choking, strangling the mother in the past, prior violence against family pets. Now, after the deaths, they also interviewed prior girlfriends who also told the review committee that there were problems or told the police that there had been problems. He was known to have a propensity to lie. The courts found he had a propensity to lie. The courts found that he forged documents and submitted them to the courts. He told Jennifer before they got married that he had a PhD. He didn't have a PhD. Much of this was evident before the courts, and still they ignored the warning signs. They were there.
What kind of factors are at play there when the courts are deciding on custody? What do they prioritize and how could it be? I'm not asking if it was the right decision. Obviously, it wasn't. How could it be that they would make this decision?
So I'm told by lawyers, advocates, and Philip Viator, who is Jennifer's second husband. She remarried when Kira was about 3 years old. He's a family law lawyer. And what I'm told is that the courts, family courts' emphasis is on giving people 50-50 custody, giving both parents the same amount of custody. And as a result, as one advocate says, then it's predetermined, regardless. And as Philip Viator says, we need to shift the entire viewpoint of the courts because they're focused too much on equal custody. And they're blind to the underlying problems. They don't see them. A recent study a couple of years ago in Canada amongst family law judges found that they said 25% of the cases they see involve domestic violence. 25%. And yet the emphasis is on giving equal access. There's also a real problem, Jordan, I'm told, in the recognition of domestic violence and in particular coercive control. So coercive control is when one partner is constantly gaslighting another. They isolate the other partner. They have control over them, but it's this insidious, invisible thing, and it's harder to identify. It's not like a black eye or a broken arm. Those are easy to identify. Coercive control is not. And I'm told by many that it's actually a deeper, more insidious problem. And judges, I'm told, Jordan, don't understand it. And therefore, they're not applying the law properly. And I'm not saying all judges, but it certainly seems to be the problem in this case, or one of the many problems in this case.
In a perfect world, that risk assessment comes back. There's some red flags on it. Both parents see it. What happens next that makes sure the rest of this tragedy doesn't happen?
Well, first of all, the Children's Aid Society never should have given the father the risk assessment just days before he was supposed to pick up Kira. What should have happened, I'm told, or what generally is supposed to happen, is that a parent would be given the risk assessment, perhaps in the courtroom, and said, okay, we have a problem and you're not going to have access until we resolve this. And then the child is kept in a safe place until they actually figure out what is going on. And that didn't happen. He was given the risk assessment. He's given every indication that he may lose custody. And then he's given his child for the weekend. It's like pouring gasoline on a fire.
What do we actually know about what happened that weekend?
Well, we know he picked her up on the Friday, and then on the Sunday, he took her for a walk to Rattlesnake Point. We know that he went off the trail into an area that was more challenging. And the report even said, you know, it didn't feel like it was an appropriate place for a child. And in decades, no child has fallen off that cliff. It's off the path, and it's not where you would normally take a four-year-old child. And when he did not come home, police were called.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.
Tell me about the conflict around this case being labeled inconclusive instead of a murder-suicide. What goes into that?
So the coroner that investigated deemed that it was inconclusive. And what that means then is it's either up to the chief coroner or an inquest jury to determine the actual cause of death. But the coroner, the original coroner, requested this report that I have been given access to. And this report will be given to the chief coroner. And this is the report that strongly states that it is consistent with a murder-suicide, a parent killing their child. So the next step is up to the chief coroner. This is Dr. Dirk Hoyer. He can determine if this is a murder-suicide, or he can call for an inquest.
We're talking right now about a pretty extreme example of how these things can go wrong. In the course of doing this reporting, and I know you've done other reporting in this area.
Yes.
How often does the system fail like this and we don't hear about it because luckily the child comes home?
One family lawyer and an advocate tells me that she believes there are thousands of cases like this before the courts right now. But again, this is an extreme case, so we don't hear about it. But another report talks about the emotional impact and scarring that a child can have. They may not be killed by a parent, but they are forever altered in the process. So we need to really care for those children as well, for those parents that are dealing with this right now. And it may not end in the same way, but there's still a real challenge here. And Jordan, we do hear about parents that kill their children. We do hear about it. Mm-hmm. It's just that Jennifer has spoken so much about it and laid her soul bare, which is devastating for her to relive this over and over, but she doesn't want Kira's death to be in vain. But we do know that roughly 30 children every year in Canada are killed by a parent. And many times it was preventable because the warning signs were there.
Is Kira's case one of the existing protocols just not working, not being enough, or a case of the people who should have been following those protocols screwing up, being bad at their jobs, or both, I guess?
I think it's both. You know, I was looking at a study in the US where it found that very often when a woman went to court and said that there was domestic violence in the marriage, it could work against her because the courts didn't believe her. And at times, in many cases, they would lose the custody battle, even though violence in the relationship by the father was acknowledged by the courts. So there are still old attitudes that still need to be tackled in terms of violence, coercive control, misogyny, and they're still playing out in the courts because I think the more subtle areas, in particular coercive control, are not greatly understood.
Tell me about what the report found that could have been done differently. There were lots of recommendations in it. What are they and would they have made a difference?
Well, there are many recommendations. Largely, it's greater education on coercive control, domestic violence, greater education for everybody involved in the system, the lawyers, the judges, the children's aids workers, as well as the assessors. I mean, there was an initial assessment, a parenting assessment by a psychiatrist who is quite well known and who is very experienced. And this man couldn't determine which parent was lying and which one was telling the truth.
How common is that?
Well, you know, I get a lot of emails and a lot of calls from frantic parents who say that the family courts are failing them.
Let's talk about Kira's mother, Jennifer, for a moment. What's it like to talk to her? You mentioned that she's speaking so openly about this and she's pushing for change. What's she doing?
Jennifer Kagan, I've spoken to Jennifer so many times and she is so driven to make change so that Kira's death is not in vain. I think that is largely driving her right now and getting her through the agony of losing a child. It's difficult for her to talk about. You can see how painful it is. And yet she still does it because she doesn't want Kira to have died for nothing. She speaks to the media. She goes to conferences. She talks to lawyers. She's started a women's group so that she can help other women going through the court process who also have been abused. She started up Kira's Law, which, and this is an incredible achievement in a short period of time, but it was passed in the House of Commons. Kira's Law is calling for education for judges so that they have a greater understanding of domestic violence and coercive control so that when they are presented these cases, they can recognize them. That bill is now before the Senate. The legislature at Queen's Park also unanimously decided to adopt some of these recommendations after a private member's bill from a conservative MPP. This is an incredible achievement. And it's all been driven by Jennifer, who's doing this for the love of her daughter, so that Kira is recognized and not forgotten. And she said to me in an interview last week that she can just imagine Kira saying, "Keep going, Mom, keep going."
Mm-hmm.
What strikes me when I listen to Jennifer Kagan is how intelligent and articulate she is. She's a doctor. She's married to a family law lawyer. And if these two couldn't navigate this system, a family law lawyer,
yeah,
what hope is there for anyone?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you at the end of this. You know, you've worked on this story tirelessly for a long time now. I know you've reported on other stories like this. And you just mentioned to me that you get a ton of calls and emails from people who are terrified navigating this system.
Yes.
In the biggest picture of all of this, as somebody who is on the receiving end of that. We've gone through a lot of recommendations. We've gone through what went wrong in this specific case. What's the fundamental problem at the bottom of this?
Oh, I don't know that there's one, Jordan. I just think that there needs to be a complete shift in understanding, more education, and an acknowledgement that domestic violence is a pervasive problem that is presented toward the courts and it needs to be understood. And I'm not saying that a parent who is abusive should never see their child. I don't think anybody is saying that, but there needs to be a greater sense and an awareness and protections put in place for this child, for any child.
Is that the big link that's missing in the courts, that link between domestic violence against the partner leading to potential violence against the child? It seems like in a lot of cases, that's where a decision is not made.
Right. But there is a clear link. I mean, if you look on the federal government's website, it does state that there is a correlation.
Right.
And that a domestic abuser is also likely to abuse a child. It's there. Reams of evidence, reams of research show that this is true. And yet it's not always taken seriously in the courts.
Is it just a matter of old judges who haven't caught up to what we know now?
You know, I've often wondered that. The judge that said that abuse was not relevant has since retired. But I think coercive control is just so greatly misunderstood because it's invisible. And another problem in the courts, Jordan, is that it seems nobody was talking to each other. You had 10 different judges overseeing this case. And one of the recommendations touches on that and says that there should only be one judge. In a case like this, there should only be one judge overseeing the case so that it's not like 10 is way too many. There's no consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Another recommendation is that Kira should have had her own lawyer fighting solely for her. Instead of lawyers fighting each other, one should have been fighting for her because her voice was lost in this. Nobody was listening to what Kira had to say. And yet she had to go for multiple doctor appointments because she was exhibiting signs of stress like rashes, stomach problems. She was telling people there was a problem, but nobody in the system seemed to be listening and taking greater care for her.
So what's next? We're waiting to see if Kira's law will pass the Senate, and we're waiting to see if there will indeed be an inquest, which should be announced soon.
I would imagine it should be announced soon. I mean, it's been 3 years this week since Kira's death. So it is expected that one way or another, her death will be determined, whether by a coroner or an inquest.
Cynthia, thanks for this. I wish I could say it was a pleasure, as it so often is, but this was a tough one. I appreciate all your work.
Thank you. It is a tough one. It's horrifying, but we can't look away from it.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Cynthia Mulligan, reporting for City News. That was The Big Story. As I mentioned, talking to Cynthia, you can find all of her work on this at toronto.citynews.ca. She'll have more later today and on Friday. Also, at citynews.ca, you can find ongoing coverage of the tragedy at a daycare in Laval, Quebec. Too many children gone. If you want more from The Big Story, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Write to us at hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca. And you can call us and leave a voicemail, 416-935-5935. The Big Story is available in every podcast player, and you can ask for it on a smart speaker by saying, "Play The Big Story Podcast." Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll have a more hopeful episode for you when we talk tomorrow.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.